Hello, and welcome to You've Got Time, an Orange is the New Black podcast. So before we get into today's episode, I just want to let you guys know that, give you a heads up if you haven't done so already, please go check out our special bonus episode with Jean Casella of Solitary Watch. We learn a little bit more about solitary confinement in America there and how it relates to what's going on in this specific episode with Sophia in Orange is the New Black. So it was a really good talk. I learned a lot, and it'll help you become more informed about the issue. Jean is an expert on solitary confinement, and the site Solitary Watch really is a place that's kind of a hub for information about solitary confinement and all the different news and reform that's going on and things that are injustices that are happening and everything that you could possibly want in terms of solitary confinement will be on that episode. So if you have already listened to it, sorry listening to me ramble about it again, but I really loved that conversation. So I hope you give it a whirl. So this week I talked to Patrick Schmidt from Netflix Life and Fansided, and you guys might know him from episode 2 of the podcast. That episode got a little scratchy, so this episode is solid sound quality, so you guys will be able to hear all of Patrick and I, the conversation that we had. So we focused on a little bit of time on a Planet Money podcast that I had recommended in the previous episode of the podcast, as well as on the Facebook and Twitter pages, about the opiate crisis in America. And again, I definitely recommend that you guys listen to that as well. In addition to that, we talked about, Nikki and Luscek and just the episode in general, and we had a really good talk. So if you have any comments or concerns about the episode, any questions for me, anything that you'd like us to add or talk about, please give us a shout at You've Got Time Pod on Twitter, on Facebook at facebook.com/You've Got Time Podcast, or on an email at you've got time@gmail.com. Thanks so much, guys. Hope you enjoy the talk. We are talking about Orange is the New Black Season 4, Episode 6, and we have a lot to talk about in this episode because we get a bunch of characters, three characters actually, back from previous seasons that had gone down to Max. The main one's Nikki, obviously, which is super exciting, but we also get Stella and that old lady who tried to shank V in Season 2, so that was all super exciting.
Yeah, definitely exciting. Obviously, the headliner being Nikki. She's pretty much the focal point of this episode. We figured we'd see her at some point this season. We weren't exactly sure when that would be after she left in Season 3. I think it was the third or the fourth episode she left in Season 3. So really, a full season has gone past without us seeing Nikki. So it was great to see her and see a lot of her in this episode. And we got a nice little taste of what life has been like, the day to day for Nikki, and as we could imagine, it hasn't been so great since being kicked on the way from Litchfield.
Right. Yeah, and we see, we do see her get her 3-year chip, which is really great for her, and definitely a touching moment because she's been through a lot since we saw her, and even with her switch down to Max, that had to be a stressful time for her, and we see that she could get her substance of choice very easily from, the guards, because Stella is using, and she's a little frustrated with Stella, but she stayed sober and she gets her chip. And, it's nice to see that even in Max, they have more treatment than even in, the minimum security prison in Litchfield, because they don't even really have AA anymore up there. But Nikki gets it, which is good. And she gets her chip, which is really kind of moving.
Oh, it was definitely moving. And Nikki had a nice little, acceptance speech when she got that 3-year chip, and how she said, she was proud of herself. And I was pretty proud of her, because it would have been really easy for her to kind of spiral out of control. It started to happen. I mean, that's why she got sent down to Max in the first place. She had the leftover heroin from V's operation, and, she got busted, and Luscek, ratted her out and sent her down to Max, and it would have been real easy for her to give in to, to her personal demons, to her addiction, and go out of control. Who knows what kind of state she was in. So it was kind of nice. Like, she was looking good and healthy and, 3 years clean and sober. So that was, she misses the cigarettes, but other than that, we were like, all
Yeah,
right, this is a
that's
new and
true.
improved Nikki. Like, awesome. 'Cause, like you said, like at Litchfield, she really only had like Red as like her, like, her like sponsor or whatever, like someone to like keep her clean. So it's kind of nice that she's working the steps and making it work.
Right, yeah, and it's sometimes, so it definitely, by the end of the episode, unfortunately, we see that Nikki does relapse because she sees this, horrifying thing with Sophia in the shoe, and she's, I mean, that definitely contributed to her relapse in some way. And there is something to be said for like a person that you're close to that you can go to when there are problems, because Nikki does, in the last season, she does go to Red with her. The heroine, and she, or in season two, I think, when Tasty gives it to her and she's like, Tasty gave this to me, I don't know what to do. And so there's definitely something to be said to have like a support system too. I mean, AA is good for a lot of people, but AA isn't always necessarily there, especially not in a prison AA setting, when you're going through something where you feel like you want to use again. So I think, the system definitely failed Nikki a little bit here in more ways than one. I know, at the very end of the meeting when she leaves with the chip, 3 year chip, they kind of take it away from her, and it's definitely a little bit of foreshadowing because the system is, the system's definitely setting her up to fail.
Yeah, I was gonna like use that same exact phrase, like setting her up to fail. Like, in one hand, they have this system in place, but it's not, it's like a half measure. It's like they're not letting her keep that chip. I mean, I would imagine they'd like hold on to that, like that is what keeps them clean. If they're tempted to use or whatever, like hold on to that chip, think about the steps and everything that they had to go through to get this chip and know how valuable that is. So without that, I mean, there's no like constant reminder or, like something you could kind of hold on to, like a physical artifact more or less that can, keep you going. So, but then she's tempted. I mean, all the temptations are right there. I mean, she could get anything she wants within an arm's reach, and she ends, she sees Stella. They have their little, meeting, I guess, out in the courtyard. They're kind of hooking up, but because this is also the first time we've seen Stella too since Piper sent her to Max. So Stella's using, we see one of the guards drop off a nice little like fast food delivery, just drop off a little pouch of heroin for her, and then Nikki tells her off. We're like, great, that's what she should say. It would have been real easy for her to relapse and use then. But yeah, to know that the guards are supplying the inmates, I mean, that's pretty much the definition of setting them up to fail. I mean, good luck getting clean and good luck staying clean.
Right, yeah, and I know, there are, just from clients that I've had there, the guards do, or not even necessarily the guards, but you can kind of, like Red from Shawshank Redemption, although he never dealt drugs, and our Red on Orange Is the New Black never dealt in drugs either, but there are people that can get things in jail. So, drugs are, people think, oh, they're locked up, there's no blah blah blah, but the system, we've been talking about for weeks, is inherently broken. So there are definitely cracks in that system where people can get substances, and in Nikki's case, it's her substance of choice. So and down the
Yeah, and
line, we see other people bring in, we've seen people bring in substances, we've seen V bring in substances, we've seen her bring in cigarettes and heroin, we've seen other people, use things, and people are going to get it if they can.
it's so weird. On like, one of the things I love about this show is that it's funny. It's like, it's hilarious, and one scene, then the next, you got some, heart pounding drama and, stuff that'll make you cry, So it's like, on one sense, it's like you got Red, like, trying to like smuggle in like vegetables and like food, like stuff to clean in like early on, or it's like a cell phone or like Piper's like underwear business, and then like juxtapose that with like the heroin. It's like, wow, this secret panty business and like sneaking in like cucumbers and tomatoes into the kitchen is like serious stuff in Litchfield. But in Max, where Nikki's been living and where Sophia's in the shoe and where Stella's at, it's like, Yeah, heroin, no big deal. Yeah, in fact, the guards will give it to you. It's just so crazy.
Yeah, and it's crazy to see that the punishments for things like, the panties or the whatever are equivalent to, or even sometimes more. Like we'll talk about it in a little bit, but Ramos gets caught with the panties and she gets what, fat recommendation for 5 more years, which is just insanity. Like that doesn't make any sense because it's just scraps of fabric.
Yeah, or Sophia asking Nikki for a blanket when she runs into her, like when she's reciting the state capitals, which I thought was kind of a cool thing. Like I would imagine, I mean, you got to keep your mind busy if you're just mopping the floors in the prison or if you're in solitary confinement. So Nikki reciting all the state capitals and Sophia from her cell saying, "Oh, you missed Mississippi." So it was a nice little reunion for them to see each other. And then yeah, Sophia just asking for a blanket. It's like some of the things, like just common decent like needs. Like she needs a blanket to sleep. She's just inside a brick room, but it's like you can't get a blanket, you can't get vegetables, but you can get
Right.
heroin. It's
It's a
like you said, it's a
twisted
broken
system.
system.
Yeah. Well, and actually it's funny because I'll actually well we're recording Monday, but tomorrow I'm gonna put out before our episode comes out, I had a conversation with this woman from an organization called Solitary Watch. And so we won't really get too much into Sophia and the shoe today, but we're gonna have some information on some like real life stuff that's going on in solitary confinement and some advocacy groups that are trying to change that. Because honestly, from what I talked about with Jean Casella from Solitary Watch, Sophia's experience is very common to many people and many LGBT people as well in prison systems. So, so that wasn't an exaggeration. What happened with Sophia, and it was, extremely jarring, and like I said before, did kind of bring Nikki back to her substance of choice.
Yeah, and Nikki wants to help. Like she wants to help Sophia. She wants to do the kind, human, decent thing. But like she says that she's trying to keep the straight and narrow and trying not to screw up, trying not to jeopardize anything. Like she's treading the line right now and she's trying to do everything she can to keep whatever sort of balance that she has in her life. So it's like, nope, sorry, I can't get you this blanket. It's like you're just gonna have to deal with it. And she gives her the magazine as, somewhat of a compromise, I guess. But then, just the dread and the guilt she feels afterwards from what happens with Sophia. And yeah, that could have been the breaking point that sent her off the edge to do what she did at the end of that episode.
Right, and that was, definitely incredibly heartbreaking. And I did, since I do have a background in addiction, I definitely want people to kind of understand more of the opiate crisis in general. So I know that we were talking about maybe flipping the script a little bit today, because I did recommend that the listeners listen to a Planet Money podcast about the opiate crisis and an epidemic in America. And it doesn't the that podcast doesn't necessarily apply directly to Nikki, because we don't really see how her addiction started. I mean, presumably she had, we know she had a difficult childhood with her mother, and some attachment issues there, and so we don't really know how Nikki's addiction really started. Maybe it did start with pain pills, but we do see, characters like Alex benefit. She clearly benefited from this system of opiate addiction in America, where people get addicted to pain pills and then it slowly trickles to heroin. And I feel like, a lot of people don't necessarily understand that, because they haven't been through it, or they don't really know what's going on, or people don't even know that pain pills are basically equivalent to heroin. They do the same thing to your body. So I don't know, I recommend, if anyone hasn't listened to that podcast, bop on over there and maybe listen to it. But I don't know, Patrick, what you thought of the podcast, the Planet Money podcast.
I thought it was a great listen. So listen to that after you listen to us ramble on. But one of the takeaways that I took from it, I mean, growing up, I'm a child of the 80s, was born in 82, going through like grade school, middle school, high school. It was like right at like the height of DARE, like drug abuse resistance education. Okay, so like growing up, it was like always seemed like heroin was like the worst thing of all time. And like you would have like just like a mental picture in your head. Like it was like horror stories. Like mm-hmm. it's the most addictive thing ever. Like you'll lose your family. You'll lose your friends. You'll be homeless. Like it's terrible. You're going to die. Like all my favorite musicians, like they die of heroin overdoses. So it was like the worst. So it's like you had this like stereotype of what someone who's addicted to heroin mm-hmm. looks like, or the type of background that they came from, or family background, financial, whatever. But that stereotype, that stigma, has kind of been changing maybe in the last like 5, 10, maybe even 15 years or so, where it kind of all started with the OxyContin, mm-hmm. like boom, the pharmaceutical drugs, the overprescription of drugs, and how heroin or opiate abuse has kind of crept into the suburbs, like the white upper middle class, like high school kid. And they don't even know it, but soon enough, they're basically addicted. They're hooked on these pills. So maybe if they get a prescription because they had a bad back or they had a sports injury or something like that, they go to the prescription or they get their prescription filled, they get their refill. Then after that, they're going through withdrawal symptoms. So it's like, mm-hmm. it kind of flips the whole script. Like, this could be my younger brother, or this could be my cousin, mm-hmm. or this could be the kid, the quarterback of the high school football team. It's not some junkie shooting up, you know, behind like the alley in like, you know, downtown New York or Chicago, like the slums, you know, something like that.
So right. Yeah.
Kind of like a whole new ballgame. Like it's everywhere now.
Yeah. And it's in, I was born in 83. So I definitely know what you're talking about DARE. It's like, you know, it was like, oh, and actually it's funny because I know both you and I watched that show, BoJack Horseman. And at one point he's like, what's the saying? Beer before liquor, never been sicker. And then he goes, don't do heroin. And it's like supposed yeah. to be funny because it's not really like that's the saying. Like you just, there's no fun right. saying about heroin because you're just not supposed to do heroin. And, you know, and you're not. But, you know, for the longest time, you know, when oxycodone came out, it was prescribed as this miracle drug. You're going to take it. You're going to be fine. You're not going to get sick. You know,
and it was so cheap, right?
Well, the
or affordable.
The prescription would be like through your insurance. So like right. you would get it, and the doctor, you know, you would pay for it. But on the street, you know, and they talk about this so well on the Planet Money podcast. On the street, pills are far more expensive than heroin. And heroin, because there's so many different people trafficking it, like Alex. And Alex does, I think she does see a little bit of her repercussions. We do see that in one of the seasons where she's talking to Nikki and Nikki's kind of telling her about her addiction. You know, Alex is a trafficker. Some of the other women that are in there for drugs. You know, we hear the Dominican ladies talking about ramping it up and starting to sell drugs in prison too, because, you know, they get caught with the panties and she's like, let's make this a real thing now. And, you know, mm-hmm. drugs or heroin is so easy, but honestly, it's just an issue of supply and demand, because you know all these people are getting hooked on these pills, which are legal, and then they're dependent, so they're incredibly sick, and they you know, or they're going through an issue where you know, like you said, like a young teenager or a young 20 something is an athlete, and they tear their ACL or they break something, and they can't compete the way that they used to, then they're depressed on top of everything. So, or someone's in a car accident with someone and the other person passes away. There's all sorts of different things where, you know, if you give someone oxys for pain and it's an incredibly addictive substance, they're gonna be more likely to get addicted to that substance. So, you know, dependency or not.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I mean, besides all the addictive properties that the drug, you know, creates for the person taking it, and you're getting this from your doctor. Mm-hmm. So you're not thinking, you know, it's not like your doctor is giving you a joint or like cocaine or something like that. It's like, oh, this is something that'll stop my knee from hurting, or this will make my back feel better. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, well, that's fine. It's like taking Advil or ibuprofen, something like that. You don't think, oh, well, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be, you know, practically addicted to heroin and mm-hmm. my life is going to be forever altered. So it's like a double-edged sword there. It's like the pharmacies are pushing this on the doctors. The doctors are pushing it on the patients. And then the patients get hooked. They get addicted. And then you have the dealers who now get to supply these people that suddenly find themselves hooked. And then You know, like the podcast, the Planet Money podcast was talking about, you had one of the guys who, you know, like the suburban guy, think life's all in order. He finds himself addicted. And then the other guy, the guy, his supplier, he's kind of like fits more of like the stereotypical mold of somebody you would think that would be a drug user or abuser, like broken home, orphanage, just like out on the streets as a teenager, just like real rough life. So it's like this guy's selling bags of heroin for $9, and it could, I guess, fill the same kind of urge or addiction, the need that you're trying to get the fix for $9 versus trying to get a prescription, you know, filled or get those pills that are so much more. So it's like you can go get a premium product for cheap. It would, I'm just trying to like get in the addict's brain here, which is can be a dangerous thing, but it's, I mean, it's like making it easy to be an addict.
Right. Well, it like provides, I mean, a lot of times for me, like when I worked at methadone clinics for about 4 years, I think, and a lot of times, you know, sometimes people are just, you know, like I said, we don't really know about Nikki's history. Sometimes people do just, you know, have a path that leads them directly to heroin, which, you know, and that's, everyone's got their own path. Everyone's an individual. You know, that definitely happens. But more and more, you know, the opiate epidemic has been spurred on by, well, A, the war on drugs, which we're not even going to touch today, but that all folds into DARE and all of that too. But two, the over prescription of opiates for use for treatment of pain. And, you know, like I said, you know, a lot of times, and I'm repeating myself, but doctors don't tell people. They come in, they're depressed, or they're just more susceptible, or they get dependent on it. And then it's like, you know, like on the Planet Money podcast, the guy, I think he referred to it as his hurt or something, but basically it was like the worst flu he ever had. But you know, it's basically like train spotting. It's, you know, you're sick. You can't keep anything down, and the only thing that's going to make you feel better is heroin, or some sort of opiate. So it's like, you know, if you're on those pills and then you're getting them off the street, or your doctor stops prescribing, and that's another thing. Like I saw so many doctors that would be like, oh, like you're a liability now because I'm prescribing you opiates when you don't really need them anymore. So you're done. So they'll just cut them off because they're not going to die if they stop taking opiates. They're just going to get sick. So they'll just cut them off. And then the person's like, what do I do? So then they get the pills on the street or the heroin, whatever's more available to them, just to stop from being sick. Which is, you know, we've seen that a lot on Orange Is the New Black, where girls are sick from withdrawing. And it's honestly on the show, it's not nearly as, you know, like I said, it's train spotting. It's hallucinations, it's throwing up, it's like the worst flu you know, if you've never been through withdrawals, it's like the worst flu you've ever had times a million.
Yeah, shoot, this is gonna date me, but I mean, we'll see like television or film depictions of someone going through withdrawal or whatever. And yeah, train spotting. I mean, Christopher on The Sopranos. I mean, for another semi-recent example, I remember when Dylan was going through it on Beverly Hills 90210. I mean, it's yeah, it's something that I would never want to experience. And you know, if I were to think about Nikki, I would think she came from a relatively stable household. I mean, she wasn't in foster care or out on the streets or anything like that. I mean, she had a mom that cared for and loved her and was always there for her, as far as we know. I mean, Nikki kept going back to her and kept, you know, getting what she could from her. But I mean, she had friends. I mean, she's kind of like the new school example of someone that came from the suburbs. And I don't know, maybe she started smoking weed in high school or something like that, and just gradually, you know, kept upping the ante, I guess, so to speak, and going to harder and harder and, you know, I guess stronger drugs. But I wonder how many people, like what percentage of like the prison population doesn't need to be in prison because they have an addiction that can be treated in a different facility with, you know, without prison guards treating them, but with, you know, trained, you know, therapists and, you know, doctors that are trained to help people overcome their addictions.
Right. Yeah. And actually, the last program that I worked in for about 5 years was it was called an IOP program, which was an intensive outpatient program. And basically, it was for people, a lot of times it was legally mandated individuals who were, you know, arrested for possession or, you know, sometimes drunk driving or usually a second drunk driving offense or something like that. So offenses that were, you know, were going through the system, and the judge wanted to see how serious they were about getting clean and sober. So in addition to doing, you know, say community service, or addition to continuing to go to court, while they continued to go to court, they had to come to us for IOP, which was 3 days a week for 3 hours each day. So that's 9 hours a week, which really isn't, you know, if you think about that versus prison, like not a big, it's like, it's not a choice. Although some people chose not to come to us, or, you know, they couldn't really, didn't want to, or couldn't control their use. So they didn't really, even try to come to the program, but, you know, and some people did. And then, you know, if they were relapsing in the program, a lot of times they would get chances, but you know, where I'm not going to go through our whole entire treatment philosophy for you, but you know, they would get some chances before they were, you know, asked, before they had to go to prison, so, or before their probation was violated, or before, you know, the judge decided that they were going to sentence them to X amount of time. So you know, a lot of times if people did well in those programs, they didn't have to do the time. So you know, they're definitely. I definitely need to do a little bit more research on those programs. It's funny because I never, until this very moment, I never really thought about the fact that those types of programs aren't everywhere, because I really feel like they should be. And like you said, you know, with a trained therapist instead of in prison behind bars, you know, there's no comparison.
So like we talk about Orange is the New Black, the prison overcrowding, there's just, you know, there's only so much space for so many people. So it's like, you know, how can we get these people out of here, prevent this problem, and then the billion other problems that result from just that one central problem? So it's like, all right, let's take these nonviolent drug offenders, you know, the people that are locked up for, you know, an ounce of weed or, you know, whatever is classified as like a small amount of drugs, you know? So it's like people that aren't the dealers, the people that aren't killing people and smuggling and all that type of stuff. I guess. Even like Piper, like what Piper did, like she was transporting cash. I mean, that's not a violent crime, you know, but okay. So for the addicts, I guess let's just narrow it down there. For the addicts who maybe being behind bars isn't, I mean, that's not the right rehabilitation. That's not going to return them to society in the X amount of years or months or whatever that they return to society after serving the time. They're going to get released and then they're going to go call their dealer and they're going to meet up with their old friends and do drugs at their old same spots or hangouts or whatever. And it's going to be, you know, the same old cycle, you know, we'll see them back behind bars soon enough. So nip this in the bud, you know, the first time. And just like, if you know what the problem is and the problem is, you know, they're an addict, then you are better equipped to solving that problem.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, I do think there are ways, and I live in Connecticut, and I believe that Connecticut is a slightly more progressive state in terms of, you know, implementing socially conscious programs that will help people rehabilitate. I don't exactly know exactly any sort of statistics about that. But, you know, I used to work at an agency that now has a program where they're in a local jail, which is a shorter term incarceration. You know, they're not there for a really long time. And they actually dose the prisoners who are opiate dependent with methadone. So they, and methadone is not a bad word. methadone is, yeah. I could do a whole thing on methadone. But they dose the prisoners with methadone so that they, when they get out, they can continue to use the methadone so that they don't go, you know, some of those people are in there for, some of them are in there for a weekend. Some of them are in there for a month, and they're in for there for a month. And a lot of times if you're, you know, going through hardcore withdrawals after a month, your body still doesn't feel right. So if you're in jail and you come out and you, you know, have no prospects, or you, you know, or you just want to celebrate, or you just want to get high again, you're going to want to go to that again, instead of being like, oh, I have a month sober because I've been maintained on methadone this entire time and I can go and get treatment following up. So, you know, I think there are programs like that that are available in certain places, but they're definitely not everywhere.
Yeah, I would imagine I guess, you know, with every state, there's 50 states. There's, you know, some are more progressive than others. Others are still stuck in the 1800s. But, you know, I think there's still just, I mean, hopefully as a society, as an entire nation, we can, you know, grow and progress and learn and all of that good stuff. But it's like, it still feels like there's an old school, like ignorant kind of stigma attached to addiction. Like, oh, well, you're addicted to heroin. Well, why don't you just stop doing heroin? Or, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, oh, well, you eat too much food. Well, just stop eating too much food. You know, it's like, for the addict, like, it's not that easy as like just not doing it, you know? So it's like, I feel like there could be a whole lot more, like, it's probably a good 15, 20 years behind, like, kind of like right now, like the stigma attached to like mental health is kind of like slowly being like eroded away and like cracked away a little bit. And it's kind of like coming more to the forefront. I don't know, maybe we're slightly behind the curve there when it comes to addiction. I don't know. What do you think?
I actually don't know in terms of other countries. Like I said, I it's funny because, you know, I've worked in this field for so long and I'm just now being like, oh, I should probably like look in. I mean, I know specifically since I worked with opiate patients for so long, I know that other countries have things like, and actually even I think it's Boston, but have places where people can go and shoot up in a safe space. And, you know, like that's something that the public would not like be welcomed. Like they wouldn't be open to that. So we're definitely as a culture, as an American culture, we're definitely a lot, a lot more shame-based in terms of addiction. You know, we attach a lot of shame and guilt to it. So a lot of times, you know, people who pass away from, you know, even these celebrities like Philip Seymour Hoffman, Heath Ledger, they pass away alone because they're doing the drug alone. You know, Harris Whittles, who was such a vibrant young person, and he relapsed and he was alone. You know, they die alone because you can't do heroin out in the, you know, it's not like drinking a cocktail or something like that. You can't do, I mean, and nor should
it be. That's socially acceptable,
you
know?
Nor should it be. Yeah. But I think that, you know, if there are places that are safe where there are nurses on staff, you know, that's like a radical thing for people to wrap their minds around. And I believe that they're trying to put one in Boston. Or, you know, there are all sorts of radical treatments overseas for opiate use. But again, they don't necessarily have this whole issue where Big Pharma is pushing these pain medications without any sort of warning. And people are getting more aware of that now. But that's a giant problem. I think that's very specific to America. I mean, maybe it's reaching outwards now, maybe as the drugs make their way to other countries and there's the generic form of Oxycontin now too. And I'm not exactly sure, but I do know there are all sorts of radical treatments that work really well in other countries that America is just chafing against.
I know you didn't watch all of The Wire, but in season halfway through the five season run, they had like one of the cops in Baltimore had like an experimental project where he like reserved one block or like one street of his district, and it was like all like the vacant houses for the most part, and it was just basically like, all right, you can do all your drugs here,
right.
Sell your drugs, do your drugs here, but like it's only going to be on this like block of houses, like whatever you do here. And obviously like he took some flack for it, but like everywhere else it was like the streets were clean, crime was down like dramatically, like it was a significant improvement. Like his bosses were like, how did you do this?
Right.
And then he's like, well, I legalized drugs basically, but there was like clean needle stations,
right,
and you know, all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of an interesting societal experiment. I mean, you know, it reduced crime, which is, hey, that's good, right? And then it's like, if you have the mindset that like, well, the addicts are going to use anyways, you may as well make sure it's safe and they're not doing it on your neighbor's stoop or, you know, whatever else. And it's like, well, you don't want them to get AIDS and then pass that around. So I don't know. It's,
right. Yeah, and
it
the
makes
clean
for interesting
needles.
Conversation, which is what I guess we're talking about now.
Yeah, the clean needles is a really, I mean, I could talk about this all day, but I you know, the clean needles is definitely something that we can start to do, because a lot of times, you know, people can't afford them, or they don't want to go buy them, or they, you know, it's there's all sorts of different barriers, and there are, you know, I actually tested the clients. It's a really difficult thing to, you know, have to sit. I tested people for HIV, whether or not they were HIV positive. And it's really difficult to sit across from someone and have them be like, I use the needle, or I know how to clean my needles, or, you know, and it's just a tough thing. People are cleaning their needles with water from the back of toilet tanks and things like that. And it's like, well, that's probably not, water's clean, but you need bleach and like you need all these things and it doesn't really work. And so if we had, you know, more of these things that are considered really taboo by society, I'm not sure how to break that barrier down, but you know, it would definitely be helpful for people to try to work their way into recovery if that's something that they want.
Yeah, I think this goes back to something that we talked about when we talked about episode 2 and Lolly. It's like, you know, you have the addicts, like maybe prison isn't, or, you know, this version of prison that we see in Orange is the New Black, maybe that's not the best environment for them. Same for, you know, mental health sufferers. Like, you know, it's, they're, you know, like Lolly, her case, like, well, she's not a violent criminal, something that somebody that's like a threat to society or a threat to somebody's like well-being. And it's like, you know, maybe there's, like you said, it's a broken system, or there's cracks in the system. And I don't know, there needs to be some reinforcements here with this foundation, because addicts, there's always going to be addicts unless, I mean, it's just, it's going to be a continuous cycle that's going to be flooding prisons. And I don't know, there's going to be, I don't know, it's like, can there be a happy ending for Nikki in this show?
I don't know.
We've already seen one overdose in season one with Trish. It's like, hopefully she could stay clean, but we, you know, spoiler alert, addicts relapse a lot, you know?
Yeah, and it's definitely something, you know, it's something we see cycle through Orange is the New Black, and like you said, The Wire and all sorts of other shows on TV, and people, you know, people are kind of like very interested in the whole idea of addiction, but you know, solutions for addiction, it's definitely a much harder beast to tame. But you know, I'd kind of to move on a little bit, Loosecheck is also kind of really prevalent in this episode, and he clearly has his own addiction issues and his own issues in general, and he's, you know, he's having some serious issues with Nikki, you know, the guilt issues and the, you know, because he was kind of complicit in the whole thing that brought Nikki down, and didn't really fess up to his part in that whole thing. So, you know, he's kind of, you know, as we were talking about the guards who are not necessarily the best. I think the last time we also talked about Loosecheck is maybe one of the better guys on the show, but he's still pretty flawed and terrible in this episode.
Oh, he's such a loser. I mean, from the opening scene where he's, you know, hitching a ride in his buddy's, you know, car on the way to work because his bike is in the impound lot, and like, he doesn't have the money to get his bike or his car out of the impound lot. So he's continually mooching off of this guy here, all the while snacking on his edible marijuana cookies or chocolate bar or whatever it was, and then pouring his liquor into his thermos. So it's like, all right, this guy is a total loser, bum, can't get his life together, 34 years old, and like, he's getting high on the job. Like, oh yeah, the line, he's like, yeah, show up to your job high so they know like that's what you are all the time. So it's like, this guy is just a 19-year-old stuck in a 34-year-old's body.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think we ever really, this was like kind of it was his and Nikki's episode kind of, because there weren't really any flashbacks, but we focused on the two of them. But I would love to get a flashback on Loosecheck to kind of just like get some context for his life, because he has a very, very kind of sad life, and he knows that he does, but he doesn't really have the motivation to kind of get up and change things for himself. And so he kind of goes to Judy King for like therapy almost. He's like,
right?
Hey,
it was like almost, it was kind of like a motherly, like, advice kind of a deal. Like, that's a great thing about Loosecheck. Yeah, it's like, I wonder, like, what kind of, like, put him in this, like, stagnated role where he's like, no, I don't want to grow up and be an adult, be a man. You know, I wonder if, like, maybe he was in a serious relationship. Maybe he was married or about to be married. Ooh. And his wife left him, or, you know, there was some, I don't know. Well, now I'm thinking dramatic and from the entertainment aspect here. But, you know, I wonder what it was that, you know, sent him off in a kind of like this eternal like frat boy, college boy. It's like he goes to one of the guards' houses and he's drinking beer in the day, like while on his shift still, and like playing video games, and one of the inmates comes in with her bloody hand, and he's like, yeah. Oh, like, what did you, you know, it's like, he didn't do anything for her. And that guy is just very hard to like. And I mean, I blame him. It's like, mm-hmm. yeah, like Luzczyk is going through the guilt thing as he's having his therapy session with Judy King. And he's like, yeah, I feel kind of guilty, but it's like, it's her fault. She's there. Like, she was the one that had the heroin or whatever, but it's like, dude, you have to recognize you're part of the equation too. Like, mm-hmm. you enabled her. Like, you should never have done that in the first step to, like, mm-hmm. even allow this, like, nip that in the bud right away. But he's like, yeah, I'll sell your heroin. Like, we could split this money, and yeah, let's do this. And then when his butt's on the line, he rats on her, and
right.
you know, he's a bad dude.
Yeah, and he's just kind of looking out for himself. That's really the exactly. only person he's exactly. looking out for. And then he does feel guilty about it, which kind of makes him, you know, redeems him a little bit. And he's talking.
Well, he should feel guilty yeah. about it, but it's like I can't remember the exact line, but it's like when he visits Nikki in Max, and she's like, you know, I'm glad you could bring up all these old terrible feelings for me, so you could have a clean conscience and all that. You know, it's like. But he should feel guilty. But it's like, you know, he went there for himself. Mm-hmm. Like, he right. didn't go there to, like, you know, it's like the people, it's like, it was just because he was wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Nikki was wrong too, but it was just too little too late in my book. And I just, oh, this guy, such a bum.
Right. Yeah. And he, you know, at the end, I think, right, he kind of is like, oh, I'm going to confess. And then Judy King's like, no, you can't mm-hmm. confess because I can't, like, lose you or whatever. And so he does decide to do the right thing. And then he kind of gets pulled into Judy King's whole, I don't know, like, her whole world. And he actually, which is,
that's one way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say she's a little bit of a sociopath, but I don't know. I don't know if that's an actual diagnosis or what, but she's definitely loves to manipulate people. Definitely. She's also out for herself too. And she's got a lot more power than anyone else in the prison does. And she wields it here. And she, you know, we get to kind of flip the whole dynamic of the guards manipulating the prisoners when she kind of gets some nookie from Luzczyk for her services.
Yeah, and it's a weird dynamic between those two and how Luzczyk and Nikki, and then how Judy King kind of manipulated that whole thing where, I mean, she basically tells him to go visit her in prison, makes, you know, really makes him feel guilty about feeling guilty, and then kind of tells him, like, you know, you just got to, you know, do what's right and be like, half of a less of a piece of crap, basically. So I don't know. She was kind of the accelerant for that. And then, yeah, she definitely manipulates him, gets whatever she wants.
Mm-hmm.
And Luzczyk is just like, all right, whatever. I'm along for the ride. Kind of like, let's do this. And then and I just wonder if, like, he was too late. Like, had he done this a week ago or mm-hmm. didn't wait until his mailbox was completely full and overflowing? Like, had he done this? I mean, obviously, he should have did it or done it immediately and confessed his role to Caputo so Nikki didn't get sent to Max. But, you know, had he done this 2 days earlier, then Nikki doesn't, maybe she doesn't relapse, you know, and get that heroin package and pay that heavy price to the guards. So you just wonder, it's like, dude, you screwed up again. Like, you took too long. It's like, yeah, you feel bad. You should feel bad. You want to confess, but then you don't confess. It's like, you don't get points for feeling bad. Like, that's another right. thing, like, from BoJack Horseman. It's like,
yep.
It's not okay that you just feel bad. Like, that's not enough, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. It's like, I'd like to like him because he's cool. He's laid back. He's fun. Like,
yeah, like, right, I yeah, have fun with Luzczyk. Cool, like, I'd hang out with Luzczyk. Totally. Yeah,
I would hang out with him on the set. I would play video games with him. I would have some of that Werther's original liqueur that he's drinking yeah. and whatnot, but... I mean, when you're a prison guard or, you know, you work in the prison facility, like, dude, like, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. So it's he's kind of at a crisis of, you know, where he's going to be moving forward here, what type of arc his character is going to go on. Because if he's at this point at 34 years old, then, you know, that mm-hmm. this might be who he is.
Right. Yeah. And who knows if he'll change. Like I said, I would love a flashback on Loose Check to just kind of get a little context for who he is. But I like him, but he's definitely struggling in this episode, and we see him going back and forth and kind of having to pay his own little slutty price at the end. So, so, but since it's, also in addition to the guard and prisoner, it's also like a male and female dynamic flipped, because usually, in the first season we saw Porn Stash manipulating women, and especially since it is a women's prison there, he's manipulating women into giving him sexual favors. And we also see woman on woman with Nikki and the guard and Max as well. So it's kind of an interesting flip from the typical gender script of sexual manipulation. So that was interesting, and we get to see Loosecheck objectified by Judy King, which was very interesting. But kind of elsewhere in the prison, there was other stuff going on, obviously, with Piper and Maria. She gets caught, and we kind of talked about this a little bit earlier. She gets caught with the panties that Piper plants in her bunk. And then Piscatella goes crazy and gives her five more, or says he's recommending 5 more years, which I don't even know if that's possible. Like, that's a crazy amount of time. And Caputo's just kind of like letting Piscatella run the prison however he wants to, and kind of just like hanging out with that chick Linda, who you're not supposed to like her, but I don't like her.
Yeah, it was like one of the first things I was thinking, like in the scene, like, what? I was like, you can do that? Like, you could just like come up with arbitrary numbers like out of thin air and just tack on 3 to 5 years for that. And she's like, she's like stunned. She's like holding back tears like for a moment. It's like, and we know it's like she just had a baby like in season one. So it's like, and she says like her kid's not going to be her kid's going to be in kindergarten by the time she gets out. You're like, oh my gosh, yeah, it's like 3 to 5 years may not mean that much if you're, Red's age or something like that. But 3 to 5 years when you're, a 30-year-old woman and you just had, or give or take, and then you just had like a newborn, like, God, it may as well be, 25 more years. So it was like you feel bad for it, because like this whole time, like how minor and like insignificant is this? Like, we were just talking about like heroin addiction and drugs for like 30 minutes. Now it's like, well, no, actually, like the serious offense is having a secret underground panty business. And yeah, 5 more years. Yeah. Like, you gotta be kidding me, right? It's broken system.
Yeah. And he's, and then it kind of spurs her on, and we see the whole cycle of helplessness here too, because she's like, screw it. I have 5 more years. Yeah. Like, let's do the real stuff, because I'm already screwed. Like, my daughter's already not going to know me. And so she is kind of like, I'm giving up. Like, that's it. Like, I'm just going to do what I'm just going to fall back on what I know. I've been trying to be good. I've been trying to do, toe the line and play the game in a harmless way. But like, let's up the ante. And and so that's kind of what we see there. But things are definitely going down in the prison with the stop and frisk. And actually, none of the Dominican girls or any of what does he say? He was like
the Latin women,
but also one of the guards, when he stops the Hawaiian girl, he's like, you look interesting. So they're just profiling people based on whether or not they're white or not. So they're like letting all the white people go. White people. So. But none of them actually get caught wearing the panties, even though Piper is the one wearing the panties. So that's the whole, parallel to how our justice system actually works too. So, but it's, it's definitely feels as we watch it that the prison is getting, as these, precautionary measures ramp up, that the prison is getting more dangerous.
Yeah, there's. Early in the season, we knew there was going to be some sort of major conflict between Piper and Maria. I mean, even going back to the trailer that came out, a couple months before the season came out in June, where it's like, what is Maria like storming off in Piper's face for? Like, what happened here? So it's like, we knew a climactic moment was coming between those two. We didn't know exactly how or what it would be about. But I mean, at this point now we do. We know. Piper set her up and planted the seeds to basically frame all of the Dominicans as basically a gang and have basically a bigger target on their back. So racial profiling is real. And it's like they're in prison already, but it's like it still exists.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's there was actually recently an article that came out. I think BuzzFeed actually researched it. And it was, even though marijuana is legal in Colorado now, the arrests for white individual or white teenagers, sorry, because it's still legal for teenagers if you're not, I think it's 18 or 20, I think it's 21, I'm not sure, but the arrests for white teenagers with marijuana have dropped like crazy significantly, and the arrests for Black and Latino populations, teen populations, have skyrocketed. So it's like, you know, what is happening there in that one study? You know, it's that's just one, but there are all sorts of, you know, information out there that shows that, you know, cops do racially profile. And it's something that definitely has to be, you know, addressed at the very least and brought to light. And that's what Orange is the New Black is doing here, which I think is great. But it definitely makes me feel like the prison is less safe, even though they're, you know, ostensibly doing more to combat paraphernalia or whatever, contraband. But it just definitely feels much less safe.
That's one of the takeaways why I thought season four was the best season yet, because it handled like real life drama and like things that are like coming out of the headlines like right now, and it was less kind of funny, happy-go-lucky like lesbian relationships in a prison kind of comedy, to a real dark Black comedy with like serious consequences here. I mean, race wars, there's that like quick joke with Suzanne selling the AR-15 assault rifle at like the Walmart store later in the season.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the mental health elements. I mean, it was just a lot of these elements and storylines felt like they were ripped from the headlines. And it's all too real, which is why I thought it was a great, great season from top to bottom. I know we're only talking about episode 6, but like, it's phenomenal television.
I know. And things are kind of getting ready to explode too in the season as because there's so much setup, and this episode was actually a really good episode. I think I was just so excited to have Nikki back because I love her, but you know, it was definitely full of different, I mean, obviously we've been talking about all this stuff that's been going on, and as the season goes on, you know, things start to really come together and present a bigger picture with all of these issues that are going on in America today. And so, you know, the stop and frisk and the, you know, the solitary confinement and addiction and all those things are just in one episode. So it's definitely something that I'm glad that they chose to address, because we're talking about it now.
Yeah, I'm glad they were able to like sprinkle in like a nice little like lighthearted storyline though in that episode with Cindy and all of them trying to get the cell phone pic with Judy King to sell it to the paparazzi. So at least we had something lighthearted and funny to like giggle about and laugh about throughout the episode. Cause episode 6 here, we're starting. That's like the fulcrum point here. We're going to hit that second half of the season. Mm-hmm. And like you said, it's just going to be one more hard hitting up. Like each episode is getting harder and harder and harder and darker and darker and darker. So I mean, obviously it's great.
Yeah.
You know, it should win all the Emmys next year.
I know, it's in that weird little pocket of space where it's like before the Emmy nominations for the previous year, but for the Emmy nomination for the next, and it didn't get any this year, which is fine because season three was okay, but it wasn't season four. So
but like compared to the first two, and then like compared to season four, I'm like, yeah, season three is definitely the weakest of the four. But yeah, season four, definitely we're halfway through as far as the podcast is concerned. But it's set up for a fantastic finish.
Right.
And that's what we call a tease in the podcast business.
Exactly. Well, there's all these little storylines too in the episode. You know, we didn't really even hit on them. I mean, we don't really have to hit on them extensively, but they do build to something bigger. So we have Joe talking to Linda about his education program. Mm-hmm. We have Healy and Lolly. They're kind of bonding and talking, and that's like a sweet moment that has a little levity to it. And Brooke and Poussey, their relationship is evolving as well. And then, like you said, we see Allison and Cindy, and even though they're talking about something so heavy as like religion, it's just another one of those funny little real life things where they're both different religions, but then they bond over the hatred of a common religion that they hate. So it's just,
it's like one could be Muslim, one could be Jewish, but they both know that Scientology is just bogus.
Yeah, I mean, everyone, I mean, I don't know. I think everyone but Scientologists hate Scientology.
Yeah, the South Park episode like a decade ago perfectly summed it up.
Yeah, that, and I think they're talking about, I'm not sure if they're talking about the book or the documentary Going Clear here, but the documentary, I think it was out on HBO, it was really good. And
Yeah,
it was like, it was just funny because I was like, oh, I saw the documentary, I know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
But yeah, they bond, and they're gonna, you know, they're gonna have a whole thing where they try to take a picture of Judy King, and that's definitely something with a little levity that's gonna be coming up. But as far as the, you know, I've been trying to kind of talk at the end, you know, because the show is so good at weaving in pop culture references. I didn't really see a ton of them here, but there's one quote between Cindy and Allison where Cindy calls Allison some hateful Monopoly shoe. and then Allison's like, I'm always the car. And I was like, oh, I'm never the car or the shoe. I'm always the thimble. So I was like,
everybody wants to be the
really?
Car.
You want to be, that your piece is the car?
Well, that's like the coolest one. Like the car, the battleship is cool. Nobody wants to be the thimble.
Oh, I'm always the thimble.
Nobody wants to be like the wheelbarrow. I can't remember. I think there's like a dog, but I can't remember how much.
Yeah, the dog.
Piece, but yeah. Car number one, battleship number two, the least desirable picks, the thimble and the wheelbarrow easily.
Yeah, no, I never wanted to be the wheelbarrow. I'd be the dog or the thimble, but I don't know why I like the thimble. But yeah, it's just funny. Cause actually also recently, I saw there are, Game of Thrones Monopoly sets. I think you watch Game of Thrones,
wow.
And they have all different pieces, and it's like the Iron Throne
I'm
and the Dire Wolf and the this. And I was thinking about like, what would the pieces be in an Orange is the New Black game? It would be like a tampon and like, I don't even know. It would be like all these weird things.
There'd be a screwdriver.
A screwdriver.
Yeah. What else would there be? Yeah. It's, gosh, boy, I don't know. But I know that screwdriver has been like passed away ever since or passed around ever since the first time Piper had that job detail.
Yeah, it's definitely been in.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Maybe something from Red's Kitchen. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just like a funny thing to think about. I was like, oh, that'd be so funny if Orange is the New Black was Monopoly, because the whole thing would be in jail and then you wouldn't be able to go to jail.
Yeah.
Like you'd have to go to something else. Like, oh, you'd probably go to the shoe, right?
Right. Yeah. That would be like the worst stuff. Or it'd be like, yeah, you go to maximum security now.
go directly to maximum security. Do not pass go.
That'd be so great to like make the community community chest and chance cards. Like, you just won the talent competition in Litchfield Penitentiary. Like, collect $10.
The job fair. She won. What'd she win? Like soda or something, or $10 at commissary or something like that. So,
yeah. I don't even remember.
So you could win. You could win the job fair.
Extra ramen seasoning packets or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Because those are super valuable.
They got to get it. Netflix has to get on that. So we gotta put our request into them for an Orange is the New Black Monopoly.
I know. They got to get all that extra merchandise. Really boost the sales, revenue sales.
I definitely play Orange is the New Black Monopoly.
Oh, I get it. It'd make for a great gag gift, too.
That's true. That's very true. All right. Well, I think we covered everything in episode 6 of season 4. And I just want to thank you, Patrick, for being here today with me again. And I really enjoyed our talk.
Yeah, I thought that was... a nice conversation, top to bottom, inside and out, and all the real life implications that we see play out in, you know, probably one of the if not the best show on Netflix. So
right,
that was a great talk, and I'm glad you had me back on.
Yeah, well, thanks so much. And listeners can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/ You've Got Time Podcast, at You've Got Time Pod on Twitter, and you can email us at you've got time podcast@gmail.com. So thanks so much.